RehabCast, the official podcast of ACRM and the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, is sponsored in part by Shepherd Center.
My name is Zach Bradley. I'm a current employee and former patient of Shepherd Center, which specializes in medical treatment, research, and rehabilitation for people with spinal cord injury, brain injury, stroke, multiple sclerosis, spine and chronic pain, and other neuromuscular conditions. Our specialized clinicians serve as complex care partners. They collaborate with medical professionals who refer their patients to Shepherd Center to help them achieve optimal outcomes, returning them to their homes, communities, schools, and workplaces.
Learn more at shepherd.org.
Welcome to the 38th episode of RehabCast from the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. I'm your host, Dr. Ford Vox of the Shepherd Center in Atlanta. This episode features rehab world takes and connections on a couple of the biggest social issues in America today. On the opioid epidemic, we look at it through the lens of the spinal cord injury population with Dr. Maria DePiro of the Department of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences at the Medical University of South Carolina. Few issues are more complicated, and looking at it through the needs of this special population, I think helps add some important insight. Then we move from one societal hot topic to another. It seems like voting rights and access are in the news like no time ever before since perhaps the 1960s. With Mark Hirsch of Carolina's Rehabilitation, we'll look at the surprising number of questions that have long surrounded acquired brain injury and the vote. Dr. Hirsch and his team have taken a creative approach to exploring voting empowerment and participation after TBI. Joining us now on the Rehab Cast, we have Dr. Nicole DePiro. Dr. DePiro is a research associate in the Department of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences, which is inside the College of Health Professions at the Medical University of South Carolina. Dr. DePiro and her colleagues there at MUSC and in Winston-Salem have published on opioid use among individuals with spinal cord injury prevalence estimates based on state prescription drug monitoring program data. So these PDMPs that increasingly virtually everyone is being required to use in the 50 states at this point, we're starting to get some interesting research results out of them. Dr. DePiro and her colleagues have a special interest in spinal cord injury, as we'll hear. We're starting to learn some things about broadly about the nature of different subpopulations, including those relevant to rehabilitation medicine. Dr. DePiro, thanks for joining us in the RehabCast.
Thank you very much for having me.
So is this part of a general genre of research, as I was kind of alluding to there, and how much of that research has been done in rehab in particular? I imagine quite a lot is coming out as folks dig into PDMP records.
This is actually one of the first times, to our knowledge, that we've used PDMP data to look at opioid prescriptions, specifically in spinal cord injury. We know that there's a lot of research that's been done looking at self-report data. There are some other studies done outside of the United States looking at opioid use. Mm-hmm. But really, we don't have a lot of relevant state-based information looking at the actual prescriptions and the prescription records.
I'm just curious, though, in the overall context of other medical conditions out there, am I right to assume that this work is being done generally for other populations, or maybe rehab is the leader in that?
Yes. From my understanding, yes, we are starting to look at PDMP data and better understand opioid prescription rates in other populations.
Now, of course, spinal cord injury, a lifelong condition that we have to cope with, a chronic condition that requires management among multiple different tracks. Certainly, if you're looking at some issues that may need long-term treatment, opioids traditionally a short-term measure, we're right to have some concerns there and be looking more, scrutinize this data a little bit more closely. In order to do that, you guys were kind of cross-referencing two different databases. Tell us about how that was done.
Yes. Yeah, so we have, in the state of South Carolina, a kind of unique perspective where we have access to the South Carolina Surveillance and Registry System, which is a statewide data set that is populated by the injury records and represents all incident cases of spinal cord injury in the state. And we've also had an interest more recently in trying to look at opioid prescriptions. And so we set out to link that data set, that SCI database, to the Scripps, which is our state's PDMP, to try and look at those individuals and assess among those with SCI, how many prescriptions for opioids are being filled.
And so you're able to identify this. I'm not quite clear how you can know for sure that you got the same person in both databases. There's some type of unique identifier there?
There is. And that was actually done kind of outside of our scope. That was done by the Scripps database, by the people at DHEC who have done this before. They were the ones who looked at, outside of our university level, who looked at linking those identifiers and individuals, and they sent the data set off to us for analysis.
Okay, fascinating. So you're able to dig in there and got a pretty good cohort of people ultimately that you're certain, you know, had spinal cord injury, and you're kind of looking into their second and third year after the injury, survivors, and their opioid use and some other, you know, related potentially dangerous medications like benzodiazepine use as well, coincident with the opioid use. And you get 269 folks just from South Carolina. So pretty good number there. Certainly a lot of good information about what's happening in your state with regards to this population. Do you think it's going to be that's a large enough cohort from South Carolina to make some generalizability, you think, nationally, what's going on?
Well, we know that in South Carolina, we actually have higher rates and pretty high rates based on the data from the rest of the United States of opioid use. So we think that it might be fair to generalize to the state of South Carolina, some other southeastern states. We're really not quite sure looking at other states. I think there's definite need for continued research looking at other state PDMPs and looking just at a more national level, whether or not this is representative, because we would like to think that it is. We looked at those who have a chronic SCI, those in years 2 and 3 post-injury. Mm-hmm. But there is always that question of whether or not it does generalize outside of our state.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we don't need to beat around the bush about the results. We can just kind of discuss them generally. Amongst the highlights are that indeed more opioids are being prescribed to folks with spinal cord injury versus the general population. And then you have some fascinating sub cohorts to that with regards to gender and race and age group and so forth. Not only are more prescriptions going out, but higher MME potentially at a dangerous level over 50 as well.
Absolutely.
Obviously, I'm sure that was your hypothesis going in, and now we know for sure that that's what's happening. What are your thoughts about that generally, and what that means for the spinal cord population?
Really, what we've come to find is we've done a lot of self-report data, and we have our background in self-report assessments and asking individuals about their pain and what medications they use for pain. And this is our first look at real-time state-based PDMP data and trying to kind of verify some of the findings that we've looked at before. And ultimately, it kind of highlights that risk for these individuals. This population has a number of secondary health conditions. They are often, even though it's not recommended, they're often prescribed long-term chronic opioids, and as we found, at higher rates than is recommended and for longer durations. This is something that, you know, considering the opioid epidemic and the overall risks of long-term opioid use, we really want to kind of dive in and figure out why these individuals are on these chronic opioids. What are the side effects of these? Is this increasing the risk of opioid use disorders or misuse or adverse effects such as overdose and death? And that kind of ties into some of our other research and kind of points to, you know, this real-time data that we can then build off of and further explore the real adverse effects and results of this type of opioid use.
And certainly one great fear that would be, you know, that, you know, in general, perhaps, is, are opioids being used a lot as kind of a Band-Aid for issues that could be perhaps better handled through ongoing rehabilitation efforts and treatment, you know, staying plugged into a variety of therapy and psychological services and perhaps more other, you know, creative treatment approaches, both physical modalities and different forms of medication approach or procedures.
Right. Absolutely. And that's kind of where we're leading with this is what else can we do and how can we better this? This maybe it's pain, maybe it's some other sort of treatment approach, but how can we improve this opioid use for individuals to try and look at other options and decrease costly and potentially risky opioid use?
Now, this registry only has the controlled substances in it. Is that right? And therefore, are you able to tell what other types of pain medications folks might be on outside of opioids?
So we, for this state database, our state PDMP, we looked specifically at opioids, and then we collected the data also on benzodiazepines, hypnotics, and sedatives. We have self-report data that looks at over-the-counter prescription, over-the-counter medications, some other prescriptions as well. And so we're, the next phase of this is going to be trying to link this data that we've already kind of drawn from PDMP with our self-report data to get a more complete picture of what individuals are reporting they're using versus what they are actually filling and what's shown in that PDMP. So we're trying to get a complete picture. And thus far, the only things that we've looked at from the PDMP are the medications that we've listed here in this paper.
I wonder if you can do some analysis in terms of that helps you figure out, you know, are there related hospitalizations going on, you know, perhaps a new procedure that then generates a new opioid prescription, you know, things about perhaps activity like changes in providers or provider activity where it seems like this person, you know, is receiving a variety of different edits over time, over the course of this year. Someone's clearly trying to work hard to maybe get them on or get them off maybe or utilize other medications or something versus others who are more static and so forth. You can kind of create, with the limited information that you have in a PDMP, can you start to try to figure out, well, what's happening generally with these people?
Yes, absolutely. And so part of the next phase, what we're hoping to do and what we can do with the data from the PDMP is look at that provider information. We also have access to hospitalization records death records. So we can take this data and link it to hospitalizations as well. And hopefully with the self-report that we're going to be sending out a little bit later this year as we begin this new study, we can start to really hone in on the participant perspective, what they're reporting. We can also link to hospitalizations. We can link to back to the PDMP to see if new prescriptions are coming out of this and kind of get a complete picture of what is happening and how these individuals are attaining the opioids and why they might be getting them.
Now, in terms of race, gender, and age, is what we're learning here, is this consistent with what is known generally with regards to opioid use nationally? I have to confess I'm not up to date on it exactly. I feel like I've seen something to that effect, but in general, what we're seeing here is that white patients are being prescribed more than minorities, women more than men, and generally, increased rate for folks under 65 versus over. Is all that consistent, or are there surprises there with what's happening in spinal cord injury versus elsewhere?
It's mainly consistent. Honestly, we did not look too deeply into the race ethnicity component because we were confined by the data set. So we could only classify it as white versus non-white.
Okay.
Yes, as far as sex goes, we do know that women do typically have a greater number of opioid prescriptions and are at increased risk for some of these adverse outcomes. And I think part of the next step as we develop this line of research is to get more information about gender, injury level, race, ethnicity, and some other sociodemographic variables that might better explain this picture.
And you've mentioned the self-report aspect. Does that include some kind of general thoughts about, you know, patients themselves about how they feel that they're being treated and what they're how they're utilizing opioids and whether they're educated about other options or feel like they have access to
them? You brought some good points there. What we're doing right now, what we have data on so far, is more so kind of what are they taking pain medications for and are they taking them as prescribed, so we can kind of get at that misuse aspect. But you bring up a good point, you know, do they have other options? And I think that's kind of where we need to start to ask more questions is, do you feel that this is your only option? Are you taking this because nothing else has worked? Or have you looked at other treatment modalities to try and improve whatever said outcome is that they're being treated with opioids for?
Fascinating. Well, clearly, we're about to learn a lot more as you delve in to some of these aspects of different databases, and in particular, I imagine those hospitalization records and so forth. So we should definitely look out to your research group to learn more about what's happening. And do you have plans to, perhaps do kind of a more of a multi-state analysis, partner with some other folks?
I would absolutely love to. If we have researchers in other states or access to other PDMPs, it would be a great addition to the research. I know in other countries, like in Canada, they've done some research, but they have a better network of data so that they can do that a little bit more easily. We had to go through a number of different avenues here with our state DHEC to get access to that data. So I think with support, especially from surrounding states around South Carolina, if we could do North Carolina or Georgia, because some of these individuals might fill in those states if they were to cross borders or live outside the state for a period of time, we could get more complete picture, at least in the Southeast. But then yes, expanding across the country would be wonderful to get that full picture of opioid use.
Well, clearly a lot more than we need to know, but this is a plethora of quality information here about what's happening in the spinal cord population, things that should raise, you know, clinicians' concern and awareness, perhaps patients and patient advocates as well, making sure folks are getting the resources that they need. It certainly would probably stand to reason, you know, the general population have a big injury, take some opioids and so forth. But as we know, not an ideal lifelong solution if we want the life to be long for a lot of problems. Definitely right to be concerned about what we're seeing in this data thus far. So I appreciate your time with us here today, Dr. DePiro. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Registration is now open for ACRM 2021. Registering for our virtual annual conference gives you access to the content for over 6 months. That's over 400 hours of CME CEUs. Go to acrm.org/register to check out the growing online program and see all of our great registration options.
Joining us now in the Rehab Cast is Dr. Mark Hirsch. Dr. Hirsch is a senior scientist in the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at Carolinas Rehabilitation, which is part of Atrium Health. Also there, he is director of the Parkinsonism and Related Disorders Lab. He holds academic affiliations with Wake Forest School of Medicine. Dr. Hirsch, thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here, Ford. Really, Dr. Vox, I really appreciate it. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you here about this subject in particular, because I think it's probably, you know, maybe a burning question for many people, maybe patients and families. And generally, I mean, society might have questions about the role of folks with various disabilities and in voting and that type of thing. And so this paper that we're discussing today probably is going to clear up a lot of misconceptions for people, perhaps. And you guys are starting to, kind of gather some data around this question, which does need to be answered. And I understand it's an ongoing effort as well. We'll talk about that. To start with the beginning, everyone, the paper is titled Qualitative Examination of Voting Empowerment and Participation Among People Living with Traumatic Brain Injury. And there's also a related information education page for patients and families themselves. It's a team effort, as are most of these papers. And Mark, you're a critical part of that team and vocalizing the paper for us here today. And I see you did some of the original work that this was based on, a smaller case series to begin with. Is that my correct understanding, perhaps?
Yes, actually, that is completely correct. Would it be okay if I just gave a little bit of background on how this whole thing came about? Because that's not in the paper, and I think that might interest your listeners.
It certainly would. Yeah, let's find out.
The idea to study the relationship between voting and traumatic brain injury wasn't my idea. It was Dr. Flora Hammond. Mm-hmm. She was with us at Carolinas at the time as the research director. And one day she came into my office and gave me a paper on voting and disabilities, and written by Jason Karlowish from the University of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And she said, wow, this is an interesting idea. We should do something on this and look at this in the context of traumatic brain injury.
Was he looking at dementias in particular?
Exactly. He was studying competency to vote and competency in a larger context for enrollment into clinical trials by people with dementia and Alzheimer's disease. So he was an expert in that area. Mm-hmm. And he happened to develop an objective tool to measure the competency to vote, called the Competency Assessment Tool for Voting, and which has been validated in different populations, including Alzheimer's disease, dementia, and now also in traumatic brain injury, which was a part of our study. But anyway, you know, I looked at the paper, and one thing led to another, and we developed a field-initiated grant and submitted that to NIDLR. That did not get funded, and we regrouped, and we decided to apply for a pilot grant through Atrium Health, which was approved. Because we said, if we can get a pilot, maybe we can strengthen a grant application moving forward. So the pilot was approved, and at the same time, in parallel, I developed an NIH application, an R21, to the National Institutes of Child Health and Human Development and National Institute of Mental Health. Then their request for applications under their funding mechanism titled Community Participation in Research. And this was back in 2007, relatively new that people with disabilities were participating in research as engaged co-researchers, so participatory action research. So we submitted the R21. Oh, and I forgot to mention that I was invited to go as an ERIS applicant, Enhancing Rehabilitation Research in the South, the NIH Grant Writing Workshop, that I think it's called TIGER currently. And it's the ERIS that I got a lot of great feedback from them during a 3-day workshop.
So that kind of helps refine proposals to make it more likely you're going to get the grant.
Exactly. And so I rewrote the grant, and the design that we used was a qualitative design as opposed to a quantitative design, which we had used for the NIDLR study. The NIDLR application. And so it was a qualitative research design with a participatory action research component. And I didn't want to jinx myself, so I essentially didn't call NIH up. I, you know, after the funding deadline, you know, after the review deadline was over, I didn't want to jinx myself, so I didn't call them. It's kind of an old belief among scientists. Don't call because they might say no.
Sure. Okay.
And so, you know, a couple of weeks went by. And so after maybe 3 weeks or 4 weeks, I got kind of nervous. And I said, you know, maybe they've forgotten about me. And I called up the program officer, Beth Ansell. She said to me, oh, you didn't hear? You got funded.
Fascinating. Okay.
So it got funded on the first try.
Okay.
Which is almost unheard of in the world of, you know, NIH.
Well, now I'm genuinely curious. Is a problem with your email address or what was going on?
No, it was just, I don't know. Maybe they had just,
okay.
It was miscommunication, I guess.
Lesson learned, no harm done, and following up after a few weeks.
Exactly. And it was funded at the full, at the full level. There was no, you know, no reduction or anything. And it, you know, they loved the grant. Good. I got, you know, incredible reviews. So it, essentially, when we had the R21 funding from NIH, we started our pilot. And I'd also like to just acknowledge all of the individuals who were involved in the study, and I couldn't have done it without them. In fact, I reached out to all of the kind of the world's experts on voting and disabilities, and most of them are residing in the United States. And I summarized the idea to them for a study, a multi-site study. And to my surprise, all of them said, we'd love to participate. So essentially, I had this incredible team to work with around the United States. And of course, our wonderful research team here at Carolinas and the TBI model systems sort of in my back, you know, in my backyard, and had that tradition and able to enroll from them and also draw on all of that expertise. So I'd just like to acknowledge, I've already acknowledged Dr. Hammond, Flora Hammond. I'd also like to acknowledge Dr. Martha Kropf from UNCC. She's a political scientist and a well-known expert on voting and voting rights.
This might be the first rehabilitation study I've heard of involving a political scientist.
For sure. And you know, just to be fair, I'm not an expert in political science. Certainly not. And I learned a great deal from this study about, you know, how our system works and how important it is for people with disabilities to be involved in political participation, voting being one of the simplest forms. But I'd also like to acknowledge Dr. Douglas Cruz and Dr. Lisa Schur from Rutgers University. They're with the School of Management and Labor Relations and the Department of Labor Studies and Employment Relations at Rutgers. And they're both just incredible scholars and researchers in the area of disability and voting. And I'd also like to acknowledge our partners on the study who were on the Community Advisory Board, because as I said, this was a participatory action research study, and the Community Advisory Board helped us actually run the study. And so we had representatives from the League of Women Voters of North Carolina. We also partnered with the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections and an organization called Disability Rights and Resources and the Programs for Accessible Living. So all in all, this was a multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary study with significant, you know, participation from all of these partners, without which we couldn't have done the study. And last but not least, I'd like to acknowledge Dr. Christine Davis from UNC Charlotte. Dr. Davis is a professor of communication studies and an expert in participatory research and qualitative research design, and she served as our external methodological consultant on the study.
Very interdisciplinary research and multifaceted in terms of that design. Rather complex, but it's a type of kind of bigger social issue, you know, drawing from, you know, these other fields that, and so therefore, you know, the research design is perhaps a little bit different than what we see. I mean, certainly when it comes to effectively like poll watching, you know, going out there to see folks vote and everything. Absolutely fascinating in that regard. Yeah, we talk in rehab a lot about being interdisciplinary, but this is interdisciplinary at another level, like literally different, you know, academic departments across campus and so forth, and obviously, you know, around the country and everything. And it's fascinating to see. I mean, I think in terms of what we're talking about, looking at folks from other areas of kind of the arts and sciences and so forth, you certainly can see economists involved in rehabilitation research. I've seen that on occasion, but these are definitely, in terms of labor and political science and everything, some kind of new folks to draw in. And it's kind of fascinating to see. So it sounds like that was a good experience for you, and you learned a lot.
Absolutely. And that's what participatory research is all about. It's, you know, it's bringing people to the table from different areas of life and different expertises, people who usually don't talk to each other directly. And you're bringing them to the table, and that conversation informs your science and makes your study more rigorous. And really, that's something that I learned, that I had to learn also, because I'm not trained in qualitative research necessarily. My background's more in neurophysiology, but now I have this qualitative toolbox to fall back on, and I feel more well-rounded as a scientist, I must say. But really, bringing all these voices together on one table, in terms of collaboration, in terms of lifting your science up to a higher level, and really trying to give equal voice to all of those voices is it's an art and a science.
Yeah. Well, describe for our audience then about kind of the general research design. As I mentioned, pre-SAGE, it's complex,
right.
But does involve the participatory angle. We've got folks, survivors, their families, folks in the community, and so forth. Certainly have a model of kind of structured interviews and so forth to gather information about folks' voting experience. I understand it involved a few election cycles. I see 2006, 2008 mentioned in particular, and there's even this component of in some cases, actually going out and observing the voting, seeing what some of those barriers are, as succinctly as you can, I suppose.
Sure.
Describe to us how this is accomplished.
So the goals of the study were to describe the experience of voting during the 2007 general elections and the 2008 presidential election. That was Obama's first election. Using a community-based participatory research approach, the stakeholders were adults with TBI who were registered to vote and who were at least 6 months post-injury, family members of individuals with TBI, as well as poll workers and healthcare professionals who care for people with traumatic brain injury. So we were out to look at the experience, that is, their thoughts and feelings regarding voting and political participation. We were also, another aim was to assess the perceptions of individuals with TBI regarding their capacity to vote, and also the perception of the other stakeholders, family members, et cetera, healthcare professionals, of the person with TBI's capacity to vote. And so essentially we collected data during three election cycles, May and November of 2007, and then during the presidential election of 2008. And essentially we followed people with TBI to the polls. We interviewed them about their experience with voting at the polls, prospectively at the poll, actually outside of the polling station in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina. And we also accompanied them into the poll to observe what was going on as they were voting. So
you had to coordinate with the election board to do that?
Correct. We had to get permission to conduct our interviews. And this was in full, we had the full board of Mecklenburg County vote on this. And there was a lot of public discussion about it, which in and of itself was an experience.
I bet, yeah.
It was, but we got them hands down. They were, you know, it was a unanimous vote to let us go forward with the study. So essentially we collected the, you know, we had the interview data. We used an interview, a script, and we transcribed the script from digital interview to a written transcript. And then we used grounded theory and symbolic interactionism to develop, to code the transcripts line by line, of which there were about 1,500 pages worth of transcripts, because we had designed the study more with from a quantitative perspective. I think I mentioned to you that my background's in, you know, neurophysiology, and we're thinking more quantitatively. The more I have, the better. So we enrolled, you know, 54. We ended up interviewing 54 adults with TBI, 21 family members, and 7 informants, 82 in total, where we could have probably interviewed half that many, and maybe we would have gotten the same results and a lot less work. But in any event, it's the largest study that's ever been conducted on the experience of voting in a specific population of people with disabilities, traumatic brain injury.
Both folks with mild, mainly mild, some more with moderate impairment. I understand none with severe impairment in this particular study, and we could perhaps speculate about what the changes might be or the extra challenges, but you do capture both folks' kind of expectations about what their challenges are going to be, and then concretely kind of what those challenges actually were, and then differences between the folks with TBI themselves and then what their families might have expected. Obviously, there's a lot of information here. We can't go through it at all, but what for you, what are some of the highlights of each of those? Like, what are some of expectations versus reality, perhaps, that patients and families saw?
Right. So again, as you already alluded to, the paper in archives is part of a larger project on the relationship between voting and political and traumatic brain injury. So there were three studies that were conducted. Two were quantitative, and this is the qualitative arm. And essentially, we discovered four themes distilled from what the adults with TBI and the other stakeholders told about their experience with voting. And theme number one was that there are barriers to voting that people with traumatic brain injury encounter, mostly at the polls. And the greatest barrier is actually stigmatization. People feel like they're, because they might slur speech or not think as quickly or respond as quickly to questions about where they live and what their address is, or maybe they're swaying a bit and appearing unsteady or quote unquote drunk. There might be some stigmatization there that is keeping people from going to the polls. And in fact, if research has shown that if people expect to have problems at the polls, even if there are no problems in reality, they're less likely to actually go and vote. So that's a very real kind of result that we take extremely seriously. But it's also a very difficult thing to sort of correct, because stigma at the societal level, I think, will take a real culture change to change around. So that was theme number one. Theme number two, the voting process can be improved. So as part of our interview, we asked for suggestions on how to improve the process of voting. And what the participants told us was to provide help understanding the candidates and their platforms, to provide help reading and understanding the ballot or the machine, to provide special areas with more room, to provide transportation and convenient locations to vote. And I'd like to come back to that point if we talk about areas for future research, to make the process of voting less confusing. It seems to be very complex, very involved, and not straightforward. To help the individual at the polls make a choice. And on that point, it is, per policy, it is okay to bring a person of your choice to the polls with you to have them help you in the voting booth. And that person can talk to you about the candidates.
I'm sure a lot of people don't know.
A lot of people don't know about that.
That's fascinating. Mm-hmm.
And then to make the ballots easier to see, easier to scan, easier to read. So those are some of the suggestions that we received on the process of voting. And then the third theme was that participants felt that voting is a right and a responsibility that we have as citizens. So it's not something that we should take lightly. It's something, it's a way of belonging to society, a way of connecting to society. And voting actually has real outcomes, health outcomes for us. There's been research to show that people who vote on a regular basis tend to be healthier over the long run. And people who are healthier tend to vote over the long run. So it's kind of a chicken and an egg kind of a question, but there is a relationship between voting, because when you vote for people who represent your beliefs and what's important to you. And if those people are elected, you're more likely to receive the benefits that you need as a population. So it's terribly important. It's a terribly important way to create a future for yourself, which is another thing that we heard again and again. And it's a right. It's my right to vote as a citizen. And it's something that I need to take very seriously. And the fourth theme is that voting gives us voice. Very often, and we know this as rehabilitation professionals, people with disabilities can be marginalized because they have a disability. And another way of being marginalized is not having a voice in our democracy, not having a say in who's running things. So this is a very important opportunity. And it's also important that family members support their loved ones as much as possible to go and vote. And if they don't want to vote, that's okay, but not to keep them from voting if that's something that they wish to do.
And that has happened on occasion, certainly, where families have felt perhaps in the best interest of their loved one, you don't need to bother with this or so forth. But I think, and perhaps that is part of perhaps this whole idea of, we're used to throughout rehabilitation for folks with any type of intellectual disability and so forth, we're kind of clearing people, giving permission to do X, Y, or Z. This is something that doesn't really require clearance per se. I mean, we all have this inalienable right to vote kind of regardless of exactly what your mini mental status score is, correct?
True. But we should also say, and in regards to your mini mental status comment, we should also say that there is research that shows that nursing home inhabitants are sometimes kept from voting because the staff are making subjective decisions that person probably can't vote. And so that person's ballot goes in the trash can. And there's been research to look into this. It's sort of scandalous, if you will. But that is a part of the problem, is that the caste system that we've developed in medicine is that we do things to people as opposed to with them. We see patients as sort of it's a one down kind of situation where I'm the physician and you're Joe, and it puts people in a one down position. It has to do with power. It has to do with the structure of how medicine is structured. And I think what we're saying with this study is that we need to have a little bit more of an equal playing field where patients and providers are making decisions that are shared, and where there's greater collaboration between patients, providers, and scientists, as specifically in the area of voting.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating, and in particular, to think about the genesis of this study and its design and everything, and looking at that data and so forth, and then knowing about everything that has happened since in American democracy, since that quaint era of 2008, in particular, and here we are dealing actually at a larger societal level right now with a lot of these same issues with access to voting and everything for kind of the population at large and huge minority groups and socioeconomic strata and different neighborhoods and so forth. And this study actually speaks to a lot of those issues in microcosm with regards to this rehabilitation population. But I'm sure you've reflected on that a little bit.
Absolutely. I think, in my opinion, being able to vote, being able to participate in politics should be a rehabilitation outcome. Mm-hmm. Because if we think about it, the folks that go through our rehab hospitals, they're all advocates for rehabilitation. They're the perfect advocates, if you will, because they've gone through a high quality rehabilitation experience, which has restored their quality of life. So why wouldn't you want to advocate for the population as a whole to receive those kinds of those services and benefits? And so I think every time if we don't focus on voting and political participation, it's a missed opportunity really to change policy on a larger level, because really what we need is for the population as a whole to get up and to march on Washington, D.C. and let their voices be heard, instead of having only a few individuals raise their voices. And I think voting is one way in which the entire population can make their voice heard. Mm-hmm. And so it's terribly important to understand what the barriers are, how people become enfranchised, how they become disenfranchised from voting, and to try to make our society as democratic as possible. Because I think what you'll find if you think about this problem a little bit more is we're getting more and more away from a democratic society. Mm-hmm. I believe at least in the last 8 years, if not longer, we've been moving away from shared decision making, and we've become more a society that's autocratic. So I think it's terribly important that we give people with disabilities, who are, by the way, the largest block of voters in this country, a voice. And
we'll be getting larger as we recognize the aging of the American population.
Exactly.
And along with aging goes decline in physical functioning, decline in cognitive functioning.
And that brings up some fascinating points. For example, close elections have been won by statistically virtual ties. If you look at the Gore versus Bush election of 2000, that came down to a few votes in Florida. And if you look at, for example, the demographics in Florida, roughly 18 to 20% are 65 plus. That's going to be the demographic in every state in our country by 2023. And if you see that there are more cognitive impairment, there's more cognitive impairment as we get older, it begs the question, who's making the decision about the future of our nation? And what kind of a capacity does a person have to make those kinds of decisions? So that's where the competency assessment tool for voting comes in, which is basically a standardized research tool right now to look at what a person ought to know about how government works in different populations. And also the research that we did on what people know about how government works by administering the naturalization exam we administered it to college students and to people with TBI. And we were very surprised that we found very similar results. Very similar results. You wouldn't think that college students who had just completed a political science course know so little about how the government works, but they don't know more than a person with traumatic brain injury.
That's fascinating at many levels. Well, educate me on one aspect of this. Is there a legal process other than committing a felony, which I'm aware of, through which your right to vote is rescinded? And why would that even be a question in a particular case? I'm just not familiar with why that would come up, whether it's someone with flat out dementia or more significant brain injuries, where, you know, a person might legitimately have a question about that. But that's not really been a major societal legal concern, to my knowledge. What is the status of that?
I believe the American Bar Association released a statement saying that any citizen who's registered to vote, who wants to vote, should be able to do so. I know that if you're under guardianship, there are several states in which you are not permitted to vote, but it's not across the board in all 50 states. So there are some states where you can, some states where you can't. If you're a felon, obviously you can't vote. Obviously, I guess I say that in question marks because I'm not really sure whether that's a good idea.
Yeah, and it can be given back, and I think that varies state by state as well.
And the reason I'm saying that is because you have to look at who are the felons.
Yeah,
and this has been looked at in terms of people who are of voting, registered to vote or voting age. Most states, the felons are African Americans, right? And at any given time, between 0% and 30% of the state's registered voters are African Americans who are imprisoned. I mean, let that sink in.
Yeah.
You know, that's terrible.
And obviously, oftentimes involving criminal acts for which folks of other races or socioeconomic strata might not have been so vigorously prosecuted, or that increasingly aren't even illegal, such as, you know, marijuana possession.
So. Correct. But to your point, I'm not aware of any policies, specific policies other than what I've talked about. But, you know, there are there's language in some of the states' legislation that people who are idiots or people who are insane or crazy are not to vote. And if taken literally, that could really bar literally millions of people with cognitive impairment from voting, if that were to be taken literally.
So some elements of the question, perhaps unanswered to some extent. We have kind of a baseline expectation at this point in time in society that folks of don't need to pass a particular, poll test to vote of, whether, it's facts about American government and so forth. Certainly not any cognitive test. Perhaps in individual cases, these issues will arise. But the broader issue is that plenty of people, perhaps millions of people, large numbers of people are to some extent disenfranchised through this kind of benign or intentional neglect of the structure of the system, kind of from expectations perhaps from everyone, including clinicians and families and folks around them, or just lack of access, folks who otherwise should have access mm-hmm. to voting.
Patients who have a positive rehab outcome tend to become advocates and mm-hmm. tend to become more politically involved. So I think, again, it's important that we consider, these kind of social determinants of health, where voting would fall under that kind of a heading. So it's terribly important that we try to improve people's function in our rehab stays to make them advocates and to get them involved politically. But let me just ask again you a question, and that is, what should the litmus test be for voting? What do you think? Where should we go? Where should we draw the line?
I feel like this is not the correct American moment to ask that question, because everything is so insane right now because there are people out there who are apparently, asking quite basic questions about huge segments of the society's ability to access. I mean, we just went through, we're still going through, this pandemic. And somehow it became a political question of voting by mail,
right?
As if that wasn't blatantly obvious that we should encourage mm-hmm. Voting by mail, and that became a political hot topic. It's just it's mind-boggling. So I would say right now, apparently we can't be trusted to debate quite a lot of questions that ought to be debated at a national level. I can only hope things are going to calm down soon.
You and me, brother.
Yeah. All right. Well, a good conversation with you there, Mark. And I encourage everyone to take a look at the paper, the series of papers, as well as the information education page, which by all means can be rehab centers can print out and distribute for patients as well, and their families would be good for folks to see. And I'm certain there'll be more forthcoming from your team on this topic. Is that correct?
I hope so, because I think this is a very pressing issue, as you already said, given the political situation currently. Yeah. So one idea that we would like to explore is whether voting at a hospital as a mobile polling makes a difference in the experience that you have to vote. And it wouldn't be difficult to have sort of a cluster, kind of a study where you have clusters where you're voting at the hospital and other clusters where people are voting in elsewhere in the community, and to compare their experiences. And I think that is an idea that the Board of Elections are very interested in, because not only are millions of Americans spending the elections in the hospital, there are a lot of voters who are in the hospital who aren't voting and whose voices aren't being heard. But it's also an idea that's relatively easy to implement, because the Board of Elections can choose the polling places. They can partner with rehab hospitals and set up a mobile polling station in a very short period of time.
Well, you know, hopefully that would have that would be an idea that could gain traction even in the current era. To my knowledge, the hospital admissions processes and ERs aren't checking party registration prior to admission. So that should be an opportunity that's equal to all.
By the way, you bring up party affiliation.
Oh, yeah.
That is searchable information, which is open to the public. For example, mm-hmm. I could theoretically search your name on the wherever county you vote in. And I assume you're in Atlanta. I could probably search your name on the Board of Elections. There's a website, and it would come up with your voting record.
Yeah,
because all of this information is stored by, you know, address and name. And it would be actually fascinating to see whether people with TBI who voted in past elections are more likely to vote in future elections.
Mm-hmm. And also maybe when you think about the intersection of political science and rehabilitation questions and so forth, do political affiliations change after life-changing events and
right.
so forth? Same thing with families and so forth. But a lot that can be explored in this area. And a few things more important in American society right now than these questions surrounding access and participation in democracy and the health of democracy generally. And I think there's a lot that rehabilitation can contribute to that
right.
conversation.
And how candidates pick or how people pick candidates is a niche area within political science itself. There's been some studies to suggest that that a lot of this is regulated by dopaminergic synapses in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of risk taking and risk aversion. And so there are some political scientists who have shown that you vote based on your brain anatomy, and it has very little to do with your political beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a fascinating area.
Yeah. And many potential parallels to what we do in rehabilitation or can understand about the human brain and so forth. So, fruitful area that I'm sure will be explored for decades hence. This paper I would say is going to get a lot of future citation in that region. So congrats on the great work and fascinating conversation. And you know, it's a good conversation. It's usually a good paper. So I encourage folks to check it out. All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And that's it for this 38th episode of the Rehab Cast. Don't miss the 2021 annual conference online from September 26th through 29th. Tune in next month and please share the podcast with your colleagues.